I did a museum show curated by Jan Hoot, and at the opening it came and the police had closed the whole show. It is the only show in post-war Europe that was closed by the German state.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.
Today's guest is the Norwegian artist Bjarne Melgaard. Welcome, Bjarne.
Thank you.
Bjarne, tell me, how did you get into art? When did you realize that making art is a profession you can make a living of?
I started making art when I was 12. My mom took me to art school, evening drawing school, and I started drawing and painting from the age of 12.
In Oslo?
In Oslo,
yeah. Yes. What were your parents doing?
My parents were working with real estate and with different businesses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and then you were drawing and your mother sort of noticed your talent and
yes,
supported
and she,
you.
Yes, she told the teacher.
Yeah.
And I was taken out of school, regular school, for 2 days a week to go to art school.
And what did you draw?
I was doing very classical studies, like still life, nudes, all those kind of things.
Okay, and then?
And then I was finished with that art school, and then I tried to get into the art academy, and I tried 6 times, and I didn't get in.
Okay.
So in the end, I went to Poland on a Polish state scholarship to Warsaw. And then, because I could then get into the second test of the art academy in Oslo, I got in.
Okay, so you applied many times at the art academy in Oslo, but they always...
refused me.
Refused you?
Yes.
And then you took sort of a way through the outside.
I was on a Polish state scholarship.
Yeah, so you went to art school in Warsaw, but then from there back to
Oslo.
Interesting.
Yes, and then I went 1 year in Oslo, and then I applied to the postgraduate institutes of Jan van Eyck and the Rijks Academy.
Ah, okay. That's very.
So I went 1 year at Jan van Eyck and 1 year at the Rijks Academy.
And when do you think your practice sort of materialized? When did it start that you do work which you would consider Bjarne Melgaard's sort of authentic?
After art school, I moved to Sydney after the Rijks Academy. And then I was contacted by my professor, Guillaume Bayle, for an international show with Jan Hoot.
Yeah.
And it was Jan Hoot and Barthe Bahr who kind of discovered me.
Ah, Jan, show by Jan Hoot was it?
It was called The Red Gate.
Okay, Jan Hoot is a very legendary curator.
Yes, he was the one that supported me always.
Yeah, he did this amazing show called Chambre d'Ami.
Yes.
Where he used private apartments, houses, yes. Farm.
And he also worked first with Jimmy Durham, with David Hammonds, with a lot of people who he discovered.
He's sort of a curator for the special ones, I would
yes.
say. Yeah, yeah. Also a bit like outside the regular.
Yes.
Yeah. But to your practice, you think that what you did at Rijks Academy, which is also quite a prestigious sort of post-study program, did you already do sort of work in the context you do today?
No.
No.
At the Rijks Academy, I did ceramics and drawings.
The first time I came across your work was at Harald Falkenberg's collection.
Yes, he was a big supporter of me.
Yeah, and these were sculptures of human-like monkeys with very big penises.
Yes.
And they were...
They were actually first exhibited at a Legend Gallery in New York. The legendary skateboard gallery.
Uh-huh, okay.
By Aaron Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And then Harald bought them from there.
So what is it about this work? Maybe you can explain.
I was very fascinated with the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to kind of sexualize and to conceptualize that whole idea of the Planet of the Apes in that show at Alleged, which was also the last show Alleged did, which was a very legendary gallery in New York.
So you always worked multimedia. You did. You mentioned you made ceramics, painting, drawings,
film.
But these monkeys, you produced them? No, you had someone do them for you?
No, they were made in London.
Uh-huh, okay.
They were made after my drawings.
So take us on how you work. Like, is it always a series you work on? And then depending on what you want to work about, the result is sculpture or painting? Or how?
I think everything that I work with comes from drawing.
Okay.
Drawing is my main practice.
Mm-hmm.
So every sculpture I do, I make a drawing first.
Right now you show a big exhibition in New York at the Fauschko Foundation, where you present sculptures and paintings, and these sculptures are humanized or sort of like monsters, and they have pockets, like bronze pockets, like a kangaroo somehow. And in these pockets, there's like Botox.
Yes.
And I don't know, other chemicals which are used for plastic surgery.
Yes.
So what is it about them?
Well, I thought it was interesting to work with these things because they are now so everywhere, right? So I got sponsorship from 5 different companies who do Botox, Restylane, everything to have in the cups. But that cup man is also a kind of revitalization of my old sculpture, the light bulb man, who had holes in them. And now the holes are outside. They are like filled with these products.
And a lot of your work created controversy and here and there scandal. Do you aim for that?
Not really.
No?
No. I think a lot of the controversies were created by other people. I mean, for me, it's not like when I make a work that I think I go out and I think, oh, now I have to be so controversial and I have to be canceled and I have to be, you know.
So it's,
but I think there's nothing wrong with controversy.
No, but
I think it's also a good thing.
But does it surprise you when you have to navigate it? Like, does it sometimes come when you expect it and then sometimes
you know, like when my show was closed by Jan Hut, he curated my show at Martha Herfurth in Germany.
Yeah.
I was genuinely surprised.
So what happened?
It happened was that I did a museum show curated by Jan Hut. And at the opening, it came and the police had closed the whole show.
Oh, wow. Why?
It's the only show in post-war Europe that was closed by the German state.
Really?
Yes. Not even Hitler closed the show.
I think that when Baselitz painted this painting, Die Nacht im Eimer, and there's like myth that he himself called the police.
Yeah, well, I did not call the police.
So, but why did they close the show?
They closed the show based on that it was images of inhumanity and idealization of violence.
Ah, but that's a reason to close the show.
For them it was.
But not from the museum, for the police.
Yes, from the city itself.
Okay, it happened many times, no? You had another show at the Pompidou cancelled.
Yes.
But you avoid this since, or is it sort of out of your...
Well, I mean, I was always very interested in transgression.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always interested in, you know, to see how far you can pull things. So of course, this was also a part of it, especially since I worked with all the Black Norwegian metal bands. I did collaborations with Mayhem, Emperor, Dark Throne, Satyricon, all of these bands.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, they are very controversial. But I think that Norwegian black metal is the only cultural significant thing after Edvard Munch in Norway. And that was also why I wanted to work with them.
Okay, that's sort of the cultural export
yes.
coming from Norway.
Yes. so that I think has any validity.
So your Norwegian identity plays a big role in your work?
Yes.
Yeah. But still you are thinking about leaving Norway now?
Yes.
Yeah. Why?
Because it's boring. And I want to move to... I'm very interested in Asia.
Yeah.
I'm interested in Asian culture. I want to move to Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And we have been there several times. And it's great.
So we can't expect so much Norwegian influence in the future of your practice?
No.
No. Or is it carried in you and...
It's more carried in me.
But you identify as a Norwegian?
Yes, also, but I'm not born in Norway.
Where are you born?
I'm born in Australia.
Ah, that's why you went back after art school to Australia?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have an Australian passport.
Mm-hmm. So, but when you pick up these, like, work about violence or death metal or, I mean...
Black metal is Swedish.
Ah, okay.
So it's an important distinction.
Okay, what's the difference between black and death?
You know, you can say that black metal is, you know, where they kill people.
Like the satanistic celebration.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, death metal from Sweden is much softer.
Ah, okay. Okay. But when you work about these topics, you do that out of like genuine own interest? And not with the aim to shock or provocative or create a result that the show get closed.
No. I don't think my intention was to get the show closed. I mean, I think it's very frustrating if you work with the show for many months and, you know, you put a lot of work into it. And then, you know, the day you come at opening, the police have closed it.
Well,
it's not an ideal situation you want to be in.
No. How did it end? The show was opened again?
Jan Hoth made it open again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then how was the reactions? How did the regular visitors react to?
It was very criticized in the German media.
Okay. How do you deal with situations like this?
I mean, for instance, I didn't get a show for 3 years after that show in Hereford.
Yeah. Because people just wanted to avoid the...
Wanted to avoid me. Yeah. I was like totally cancelled.
Yeah. But not for the first time. Like how often have you been cancelled?
Quite a few.
Like what? Like 3-4 times?
Yes.
Yeah. How do you deal with it?
You deal with it. I mean, what are you supposed to do? You know, I mean...
Yeah, you can't do much, huh?
You can't do much.
Yeah.
I mean, either people understand your work or you don't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I also think that my work is... I mean, I personally... I don't need to be, like, understood by everybody. Or I don't need to be liked by everybody either.
You're doing this for quite some time. What's your view, looking back and at today's art market and the art industry... maybe you can explore your view on the art market trends in the contemporary art world today.
I don't follow so much the art market trends.
I mean, from your own experience.
I think it's getting harder. I think that people are afraid. I was in New York now, and it's a totally different city. You have the feeling people don't dare to say anything anymore.
And how's it in Norway?
It's also a bit the same.
Mm-hmm.
I think the freedom of speech is getting less and less.
And how does it influence your practice?
It influences me on the way that I wanted to say more.
Yeah, because, I mean, all your work is very direct and influenced of your presence, I would say. We did an exhibition in Tokyo, and the paintings were all over COVID rats, which I interpreted it as sort of COVID rats. So it's a very direct, impulses you get and influences by our today's life, which then make their way to painting. Is that correct?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. But then at the same time, you were always someone who was very at the forefront of industrial production or outsourcing concepts. Like now you produce in Bangkok sculptures.
Yes.
Where you sort of give away the final decision on how to execute it?
Like in the concept for the sculptures for Farshkar Foundation New York was that I wanted to give the workshop in Thailand just one drawing of a sculpture,
mm-hmm.
and then say, transcribe this,
mm-hmm.
interpret this one drawing.
Yeah, like a cup man, so, as you call
it. So you don't even know what kind of result you get.
Yeah.
Because I think that's very interesting when you also want to lose control of your work.
And why do you give that artistic decision away?
Because I think that a lot of artists, they hold on so hard to their own identity and mm-hmm. their own work,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I sometimes think it's something with being able to give it away
mm-hmm.
and to let it become something else.
Also to bring a certain distance into it?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also bring something, hopefully something new to it.
Yeah. But at the same time, you had the issue, because you are like a quite public persona in Norway. And I mean, it's a small country, but you are like the probably most famous artist in Norway. You had an issue with your copyright infringement, no?
Yes.
So tell us about it.
It was a huge court case, and it was my investors. I signed contracts that I shouldn't have signed.
Mm-hmm. And you had investors for what? So you sold your copyright, or
yes?
Why would you do that? Because you needed money.
Because I needed money.
Yeah,
and then I was also living a very extreme lifestyle.
Yeah,
you know. So they took advantage of that.
And what did you sell, like copyrights of merchandise things or what?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Tell us a bit about what's the perception, maybe difficult to explain, but what's the perception of the Norwegian people of you and how you engage with the audience there?
I think I have a very good relationship with the Norwegian audience.
Yeah.
You know?
Because they took the copyright for a reason, because there's money to make on
yes.
merchandise
yes.
and things like this.
Yes.
Yeah. And, but you have that back now.
We're working on the court case, yes.
Ah, okay, okay. Yeah, maybe take us to the most recent project in Fausko. You mentioned the sculptures, but you also show a large number of paintings there.
Yes.
How do you work on the paintings?
I work very directly with the painting.
Yeah.
Like I think that for me, it's like a painting is, let's say I paint a painting of a cow.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a painting of a cow.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. And you know, like, I mean, I want the painting to be the painting itself.
And are you critical to your own paintings that you say, okay, this worked out and this one didn't?
No, because I feel like I work like in an emotional series.
Yeah.
You know, like I want to say something.
Yeah.
And I usually work in a series.
So it's a constant flow.
Yes.
Yeah. And but do you edit it afterwards?
Yes.
Yeah, and then you choose.
And then I usually start on something new.
Okay.
Because I also like to do new things all the time. I don't want to repeat myself all the time with the same painting, the same sculpture, the same work.
Yeah. So did you ever came back to the monkeys at Falkenberg?
No.
No. So you do everything once, and then you move on.
Yes.
And then you have faces you work, and you also have faces probably you don't work.
Yes.
Yeah. But after this sort of process of production, with what distance do you then look back? Or is your husband helping you choose, or the respective curator, dealer? Like, how do you get it?
I choose. I mean, if I make a painting show, let's say I make 20 paintings, I will select 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's my own selection.
But you bring a distance to the sculptures, but not to the painting.
Yeah.
Yeah. How come?
Painting is a different medium for me. It's more emotional.
Okay.
Because it's also based on the color.
Yeah. But you mentioned you did clay sculptures.
But, I also did clay sculptures.
Yeah, but yes. Now when you do the large sculptures, they have to be created based on drawings.
Yes.
Not on your small clay models you create.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you ever bring that distance into painting?
I also in New York, when I moved to New York, I had assistants painting my paintings that I worked on. I had a 2,500 square feet studio in Bushwick.
Okay, you had assistants. A big production, yeah.
Big production.
Yeah.
In New York when I lived there.
And then you noticed that's not the way to go.
For me, it wasn't the way to go anymore.
Yeah.
I wanted to go into an intimate studio situation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned films, which you did also.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Well, I made several films about, you know, all kinds of stuff.
And they're like art installations or really feature films?
They are art films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how is the film influencing the painting, the sculpture? Is it always like the same?
I think that I see everything in my work as one work,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, I do film, I do painting, I do drawing, but I just see it as a part of one big work.
You did a virtual reality piece too with Acute Art.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tell us about this, because that you mentioned me now, it's like the world of Bjarne Melgaard. And this was like literally you took on these 3D glasses and you were entered in a dystopic world somehow, no?
Yes. I mean, it was almost like a mini retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we took Acute Art, who, you know, it was curated by Daniel Birnbaum. We took all works that are done, sculptures, paintings, drawings, and we put it into this virtual reality piece that was shown at Julia Storcheck in here in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was shown now at Outernet
mm-hmm.
in London, which is England's most visited exhibition space. It mm-hmm. has 200,000 visitors a day because it's just on Oxford Street.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Acute Art condensed the piece down to 7 minutes
mm-hmm.
and it was shown all over the walls and the floor and the ceiling and everywhere.
Because
at Outernet.
But isn't the point of like that you can navigate yourself with these 3D glasses?
Yes.
Yeah.
This was a more film version.
Like a reinterpretation.
Yes.
Yeah. And these you let other people then execute.
Yes.
Yeah. And you mentioned Edvard Munch. What are your influences? Are there other artistic influences in your practice?
I think that I'm more influenced by Art Brut, mm-hmm. Kubra, Jean Dubuffet, also literature like Michel Bernstein, Guillaume Dustin, things like that.
Then other, not so much Munch, yeah?
I'm not so particularly inspired by Munch. No.
Yeah, yeah. And where did you get your influences into from a new series? It just comes, or you?
I think the new series at Farshkar Foundation was based very much on being in this court case.
Ah, interesting.
Feeling like you have your work raped,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that, it, you know, suddenly it didn't belong to you anymore. So I think that a lot of those paintings were dealing with, you know, that whole feeling of, you know, having, you know, lost control of your own work in a way.
But how is it with sort of self-responsibility? Because you brought yourself into this situation
yes,
too, no?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to learn from.
Yeah. And
but I'm an artist. I'm not an accountant.
Yeah.
So also, you know, I had people working for me in New York who were supposed to take care of things.
Yeah.
And they totally screwed me over.
Okay. You talk about these times when you said you were like you had a difficult lifestyle, which
yes.
led you to yes. make agreements you shouldn't have done.
Yes.
Maybe you can share how did you get yourself out of it?
I married the best man in the world.
And he helped you get out of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And he probably helps you also to go through.
We are a team.
Being cancelled.
Yes.
Yeah. But you can't avoid getting cancelled.
My Munch Museum show got cancelled. My retrospective at Munch that I worked with for 4 years
yeah.
got cancelled. And it was very interesting because, you know, it would have not been a retrospective that was just about me.
Yeah.
But it would have been about queer identity and all my queer references. And I think that, you know, that would have been so important now in the times where, you know, we have more hate crime than ever. You know, the laws against gays and lesbians are, you know, getting less and less. And they canceled it.
And so you think that the awareness for queer is only for a few, or it can't really resonate if it's too controversial, if it's too subculture driven?
I think it was too controversial for the museum, yes.
Yeah. But do you try to adjust and be like less provocative to not continue getting cancelled? Or is this nothing you have an influence on?
I think I want to stick to my ideas.
Yeah.
I want to stick to my visions.
But you feel compromised by the current climate?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. And so what do you do? How do you...
You just continue and you work.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, you...
But you don't hold back?
No.
No. And take the risk being cancelled again?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But then what I understood really is that you couldn't really pre-see it before, and then sometimes you got along with it or away with it.
Yes.
There was no problem. And other times you wouldn't have expect problems, they were some.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's hard to...
It's hard to navigate.
Yeah. And hard to project in the future.
And perceive how things will be.
It's interesting. Another experience where I came across your work was in Norway. I visited a collector. And then he was so obsessed with your work, and he had, I think, 60 paintings of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are few people who are really, I mean, like, I remember also Harald Falkenberg, you were his favorite artist. There's some collectors or institutions or people who are really obsessed with you, no?
Yes, I had.
Yeah.
You know, especially in Belgium and the Netherlands in the 90s and early 2000s.
But also this is like nothing you can influence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and in the project coming up in Seoul, you have a idea already on what you want to work on?
Yeah, I want to make new paintings. I want to make new sculptures.
And they're going to circle around what?
I have an idea that I haven't told you,
mm-hmm.
that I wanted to make these sculptures of men fighting with lions,
mm-hmm.
big ones.
And sort of human representation, because the cup man you did in New York now, they have their sort of human-esque, but they're not really clearly...
Yeah.
Yeah. So here you are envisioning same sort of creatures or really male representation sculptures?
Something in between.
Okay. And the paintings?
I haven't planned yet.
Okay. But this court case stress, which sort of made its way to the painting, that's over?
Yes.
Yeah. Where's the lion coming from? Like, where's the...
I always had a fascination with tigers and lions.
Mm-hmm.
Like at Ramekin Crucible, I actually exhibited live tiger babies.
Oh, wow.
And so I had like always a very special fascination with tigers and lions.
So how
do that has been a recurrent theme,
mm-hmm.
also in my drawings and paintings.
And how did you exhibit tiger babies?
We had them in the gallery in a cage? In a cage, yes.
Uh-huh. And that didn't trigger the next scandal?
Yes.
It did. I can imagine, yeah. Okay, so you look a little bit far.
We had the tiger babies for 2 days, and then there were protesters outside, so okay, we had to send them back to the farm.
But I think that it's not really just like happening to you. I think that you're sort of looking for the scandal and the conflict and figuring out where's the border, how far can you go, no?
Yeah.
Yeah. But and then revisit and next sort of recover and then go again and
yes.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Great. Did you ever consider teaching?
I have taught.
Oh, yeah. How did that go?
When I did the Venice Biennial in 2011, I was a professor for 1 year at the university in Venice.
Also, when you did the Norwegian Pavilion?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And I taught with Clementine Delis and with Leo Bersani and with several others.
And you have the feeling you can share something with like a next generation of artists?
I like teaching.
Yeah?
Yes. But I right now I would like to concentrate on my own work.
For energy resource reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But didn't you do some sort of mass market things in Norway?
I did an edition of The Light Bulb Man for a show in Norway where we sold 130 sculptures in 8 hours. And it was also interesting because, you know, since this court case was writing about that my market was totally falling down, I sold 130 sculptures in 8 hours.
Tell me more about The Light Bulb Man.
That's a character I worked with since my first solo exhibition at the Stedelijk Museum in 1998. And it has been a recurrent theme in my work ever since. But at the last show in Oslo, where I made 130 of them, that was also the end of that sculpture.
Okay.
Because I wanted to concentrate on making new ones.
So it's in sort of an alter ego of yours?
Yes.
Yeah. Like enlightened, but yes. Fragile.
Yes.
Yeah. Because like literally like a light bulb.
Mm.
Yeah. It's also not climate conform anymore, you know,
yeah.
the classic light bulbs.
Yes.
But the holes, so the light bulb man was not carrying light bulbs.
No.
He was just ready to carry them.
It was supposed to have light bulbs inside, but it never worked.
Yeah. And the next one, are you going to put the same figure in its own pockets?
Then we're going to make small sculptures that goes in the pockets.
Uh-huh. So
each cup man is supposed to be unique.
Okay.
So you know, like the next one will have small sculptures lying in the cups, and the next one will have something new.
So the cup man has somehow the product carrying in himself to improve.
Yes.
Like human, like visual improvement.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, exciting. Thanks for joining us in the podcast.
Was mit Kunst? Ein Podcast von und mit Johann König.